Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, a look at the issues that affect the residents of the Central Valley.
Welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and we do hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. On our program today, what is the future of the Republican Party? And a tradition returns to Kearney Mansion for the holidays. But first, for years, California voters have been at the forefront in approving new reforms and ballot measures, from Proposition 13 to legalizing medical marijuana. But in many cases, those reforms also bring with them unintended consequences. And one of those reforms, approved by voters just 2 years ago, is doing just that. Some are concerned the state's new system governing primary and general elections could put the state's smallest political parties at risk of extinction. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
When California voters approved Proposition 14 in 2010, supporters hailed it as a way to make many races for Congress, the legislature, and state offices more competitive, thanks to a new top two election system. But now, with the first full election cycle under the new process complete, some are worried that this effort at reform could also lead to the demise of some of the state's smaller political parties, even possibly stripping them of their eligibility to appear on future primary ballots.
This reform specifically hurts third parties.
Because, as Eric McGee of the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California says,
the way that parties actually become qualified for the ballot in the first place, even to run in the primary, is based on their showing in previous elections.
And specifically previous general elections, the same ones that under the reforms of Proposition 14 now only feature two candidates, the top two vote-getters from the primary election.
And the opportunity for minor parties to do that in the new top two scheme is much, much more limited.
That's Kim Alexander of the nonprofit California Voter Foundation. In fact, in the November election, just three candidates from the so-called minor parties and five no-party preference candidates made it to the general election ballot. Part of the problem, according to Alexander, involves the legislation that was needed to implement Prop 14 after it was approved by voters.
Prop 14 was drafted pretty quickly. It's important to remember that it was a last-minute bill that was put on the ballot in 2010, and it was not crafted that thoughtfully, and in fact, it required major cleanup legislation the following year to make it ready to actually be implemented.
So exactly how does a political party qualify or remain qualified for the ballot? And what about those changes made by the legislature that supposedly hurt third parties? We asked Keith Smith, professor of political science at the University of the Pacific in Stockton. It turns out there's actually three ways for a political party to qualify.
The first one is that a party has to get 2% of the vote in a statewide constitutional office. So, for example, governor, lieutenant governor, insurance commissioner, one of the party's nominees has to get 2% of the final vote. For the minor parties, that option is basically gone.
And that's important because, as Smith says,
the four minor parties that are there all got at least 2% of the vote for insurance commissioner in 2010.
The numbers are based on the vote in the last gubernatorial election, in this case 2010.
The second way that they can be qualified is if they register partisans totaling 1% of the gubernatorial vote in the last election. And in looking at the 15-day registration statistics, the American Independent, the Libertarian, and the Green Party now have 1% of the gubernatorial vote registered as members of their parties. The Peace and Freedom Party does not. The Peace and Freedom Party is about 50,000 people away from having 1% of the gubernatorial vote in 2010.
That means if all else stays the same, after the 2014 election,
candidates won't be able to affiliate with the Peace and Freedom Party anymore because they won't be qualified.
And if the other parties fail to maintain their voter registration numbers, they could fall off the ballot as well. This provision also hurts third parties because in many cases, a lot of people who in the past voted for a third party candidate were actually registered with another party, a Democrat voting for a Green Party candidate or a Republican voting for a Libertarian. And Michael Feinstein, spokesperson for the Green Party of California, says the top two system makes the voter registration option even more difficult, especially since historically voters tend to stay home for the primary and only come out in big numbers for the general election.
It's harder to get people to register in your party if you're never on the ballot.
That leaves parties one last option to make it on the ballot, a very expensive one, petitions.
The third way that you can be a qualified political party is if you gather petitions equaling 10% of the gubernatorial vote. And that's a higher threshold than getting a ballot initiative or a constitutional ballot initiative qualified. And this is how Americans Elect got on the ballot, is they paid to have signature gatherers get 10% of the registrant population to say, yeah, we should have Americans Elect on the ballot.
So the last option is very expensive, and the first option highly unlikely, leaving Libertarians and Greens only the voter registration option as a way of staying on the ballot and off the unqualified list, which is populated by such well-known political voices as the California Pirate Party and the We Like Women Party. But the challenges for third parties don't stop there. The legislature also raised the fees and requirements for candidates themselves to get on the ballot. Professor Smith.
Even small changes in filing fees or signature requirements can significantly drive down the number of third-party candidates.
Michael Feinstein of the Green Party says he thinks it's part of an effort by the Democrats and Republicans to keep third parties off the ballot.
It used to be that we needed 60 signatures for a state assembly race in lieu of paying a filing fee. Now we need 1,500. We used to need 150 for governor. Now we need 10,000. So on every level, this is designed to reduce voice and options for the California voter.
The final major change as part of the top two system removed one other option from the general election, write-in candidates. That, too, doesn't go over well with Feinstein.
When you think back to the state of Alaska a couple of years ago, when Lisa Murkowski, the Republican incumbent, lost the primary to a Tea Party faction candidate in the Republican primary, and then she ran as a write-in in the general and was elected. We no longer have that option, and instead the system just renders a false majority.
So what might the future hold for third parties in California and the new election reforms? Feinstein says he thinks the courts will overturn Prop 14 and related laws for presenting what he calls unconstitutionally high barriers to participation in the general election. And even supporters like Kim Alexander advocate making changes to reduce the effects on California's smaller parties.
I hope the legislature revisits the impact that the top two primary system is having on minor parties in California. They are an important part of our electoral landscape. There are a lot of Californians who feel that neither the major parties represent their interests, and we don't want them to feel like there's no place for them to go. So we really need to have a system that enables third parties to have a presence in the California political process.
And it's that system that may ultimately decide the fate of California's third parties. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Thank you, Joe. In the aftermath of the November election and the loss of Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential candidate, the GOP, has been doing some self-examination of the party. Why did Republicans experience such a loss? Is the party becoming irrelevant? And what will it take to get the public to support its candidates, its platform? What is the future of the Republican Party? Joining us for our discussion today is Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University and also a Selma resident. You've also read his columns in the Fresno Bee. Thank you so much, Mr. Hanson, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Professor Thomas Holyoak, associate professor of political science at Fresno State. And thank you both for being here today.
Good morning.
Now, when you take a look at what's happened over the last few weeks, what we really have going on with the Republican Party is really more than a little Monday morning quarterbacking going on. There is huge discussion. Mr. Hanson?
Well, there's a lot of discussions that as I understand it, there's no consensus. There's maybe two camps. One is that they didn't articulate their message and that a lot of voters who would have helped them stayed home. 4 or 5 million in the key swing states, talking nationally now. And then the other is that they're a party that was not able to get more than 30 to 35% of key segments of the new electorate, so to speak, Hispanics, African Americans, young people, etc. And so I guess that the dilemma for them is that they don't know whether they have to get out the vote more of their natural constituents, working class whites, middle class people, or they have to appeal, or they have to do both. And that seems to be what they're internally debating right now.
Professor Holyoke, isn't, and you too, Mr. Hansen, but isn't this kind of self-analysis good? I think any party after a loss would want to take a step back and kind of look at where they are.
Absolutely. I mean, after all, if a party loses a major election like the presidency and also suffers some actually surprisingly significant defeats in the United States Senate, then you know, that party does need to figure out what went wrong and what to focus on in the future if it hopes to be a viable party.
And Mr. Hansen, also some of what you see and the initial comments coming back, like you said, there are two schools of thoughts there when it comes to the self-analysis. But some seem to think that, you know, going forward, perhaps just selecting a candidate with a Hispanic name, and that might kind of solve the party's problem. It's much more than that, isn't it?
I think it is. If you look at all the major blocks, and if you want to go down the tribalism route, actually white, so-called white voters were more likely to vote for non-white candidates. 40% roughly of the people who turned out and called themselves white voted for Barack Obama in the way that that's not true, say, for example, of African Americans. So I don't think you really want to go down that route and say that we're not individuals, we're just part of a collective tribe. That's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing is, I think the Republican Party's problem was a populist one. If you look back to Ronald Reagan, they've only won two presidential elections, George H.W. Bush in 1988 and George W. Bush in 2004. Whatever your own politics are, you can go back and see that somehow Lee Atwater, the late Lee Atwater, painted Michael Dukakis as an effete Cambridge, Massachusetts snob with a, you know, motoring around in an Abrams tank who let out Willie Horton. And they turned in the aristocrat George Bush into a pork rind-eating populist who motorboated in choppy waters. The only other time they were able to pull that off was 2004, when Karl Rove convinced the electorate that John Kerry was a windsurfing, spandex-wearing, wetsuit, mansion-living elite. Otherwise, they get characterized that, and $200 million convinced the electorate that Mitt Romney was a out-of-touch, snobbish, wealthy guy with an elevator in his house. By the same token, no, until Barack Obama, for the last 50 years, no Democrat had been elected without a Southern accent. It was just a rule of thumb that if you were a Northerner, George McGovern, Michael Dukakis, Walter Mondale, John Kerry, you couldn't get elected. You had to be LBJ or Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, or even Al Gore won the popular vote. But some idea that a Southern accent made you authentically centrist and you weren't a far-left liberal. And that was pretty much the rule. It's changed because of Barack Obama, but I think there's something to it. So if the Republicans, I don't think so much the ethnic fides is that important of the candidate, but they've got to get a candidate that comes from the middle class or the upper middle class or feels comfortable with people. If Romney had felt comfortable going into a place like Fresno, even though he was going to lose California, and make the argument that his policies would help people using a conservative approach to appeal to people not like himself, I think he would have done better with independents in the swing states who would have seen that effort. And I think that was the problem, that he was easily caricatured as somebody like John Kerry, who was caricatured in 2004, like Dukakis was caricatured in 1998.
But also I want to bring in Dr. Holyoke as well with this part of the conversation when you talk about the characterization. But that was going on both sides. And if you kind of step back and look, some of what happened is Mr. Romney didn't do himself any favors because sometimes he kind of you know, would fall right into what some of those negative characterizations were.
Well, part of what happened, though, is that the Obama administration started much earlier to define – that's not the Obama administration, the Obama campaign – much earlier in the summer started its efforts to paint Mitt Romney as an out-of-touch plutocrat. And that was a point when the Romney people were not able to effectively respond. They were wrapping up what had been a very, very bloody primary and trying to raise money to, you know, for the general election. So they weren't able to fight back at that point. And so the Obama campaign successfully defined Mitt Romney that summer. And Romney started to come back from that, but never succeeded that transition.
Do you think that was part of it? Because I do think he was coming back from that, even though it had been months and months and months. You did see after that first debate, I mean, people were willing to give him a second look.
Yes, I think that's a very good analysis. And I think that the people I had talked to said that he was short money. He even had to borrow money in key months like April and May. And by the time he raised money, and he had to go to places where he wasn't going to win, like California, made six or seven stops to raise money because there was money there, but there were not votes. And he was sort of desperate, and he was defined. And I spent the month of September teaching in Michigan. I was just shocked about the commercials. They were so effective in painting him as a, as I said, an aloof, uncaring person who cheated on his taxes and was willing to let people die without health insurance. But he never really caught up. And he was defined. And had he had the money, or had he realized his exposure, and he could have done a negative advertising against Obama and said this guy goes to Martha's Vineyard, he's that it would have been more difficult, but it would have been something, and he could have tried to protect him from that. But he did a lot of other things. No Republican candidate of that class should ever appear on a jet ski with a wetsuit. You know, that was just crazy.
I missed that. Everybody else talks about it, but I happen to miss that. But
it was sort of like John Kerry windsurfing.
Yeah, you never forget those images. But the other thing is what you're saying, and I think many of us here in California, we don't have an idea or depth of the ads, because they really weren't shown here in California. But in some of in a lot of those swing states, you know, from what you read and what you hear, it was just absolutely brutal.
I'll take up on that one. Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, California was not considered a state that was in play, so to speak. It was, you know, largely ceded by the Republican Party to the Democratic Party and not part of the Romney strategy. So we didn't get the benefit, curse, whatever you want to look at it, of having constant presidential advertisements on all the time. We had our own political advertisements, but those were over Prop 30 and Prop 32. And it just wasn't the same kind of siege that they had in Ohio and Florida and Virginia.
But when it comes to winning an election, is it more personality than policy? Or is it whoever can tell the story the best?
Well, I think there's a certain type of candidate that pushes buttons. In the case of Ronald Reagan, he was a very good speaker, especially an impromptu speaker. And although he was identified, they tried to caricature him as a wealthy guy. If anybody's seen his ranch up in Santa Barbara, it was just almost a hovel. And he grew up in the middle class, and so he was able to deflect that. And he was an ideal candidate. Republicans don't find candidates like that. By the same token, there was sort of the same mystique about Barack Obama. It wasn't just that he was the first African-American candidate. He was of mixed race. He was young. He was Ivy League. He had a multicultural sounding name. He had a lot of differences about him that other African-American candidates didn't have and won't have. So he was sort of like Reagan in the sense that I don't see the Democrats nominating somebody with that natural appeal in the way that the Republicans haven't been able to nominate someone like Reagan. So I think that in the next cycle, we're going to get back to a more on the tactics and strategy, and it won't be just the singular charismatic draw of a particular candidate. I don't see anybody in the Democratic or the Republican, maybe Marco Rubio, but I don't see anybody with a Reagan or Obama mystique about them that otherwise excuses campaign errors or lapses or gaffes.
I actually would like to just also add a few other things on to that. Certainly, the Republican parties had a candidate problem in the sense that their candidate was defined as being essentially out of touch, you know, being so much richer than everybody else. But the Republican Party has some structural problems too. And you know, we alluded that to a little bit earlier in this segment, that growing minority populations broke for Democrats in huge numbers, just as they did 4 years ago. That's a problem the Republican Party needs to deal with. The Republican Party also has a structural problem in terms of the states. The battleground states in this election, all just about all, with the exception of North Carolina, broke for Barack Obama. The Obama campaign organized extremely well, showing the advantage of having an on-the-ground organization. And some of the traditional battleground states like Virginia are slowly moving into the Democratic side of things. Virginia used to be a pretty solid Republican state, at least in the last few elections, and it's becoming increasingly blue. Florida, too, as we saw, cannot be counted on to be a Republican state. The Republicans need to do something about that, because if they become defined as purely an old South party, they will not win elections in the future.
Mr. Hansen, what does the Republican Party need to do? Because that's what you see, and you see it constantly. They talk, and they have talked about this for years, needing to attract a more diverse group of people, but have never really been that successful.
Well, as I said, I think for them it's not so much a racial as a class problem. They have to find people of all different ethnic backgrounds who believe in free markets and individualism and less government dependency, and who've lived that life, that are not financiers or members of the aristocracy. And I think that would appeal to people. For example, if I live in Selma, so most of the people I see every day are Latino, and I grew up there. So I don't think the Dream Act was what Latinos were voting for. The people I talked to said the Dream Act was the beginning. They wanted blanket amnesties, and they said that they wanted more government, and they voted for Prop 13 because they felt that wealthy people should pay more. So these are issues that transcend just immigration, and I don't think that there was much Romney or anybody could do to 96% of the African-American vote went for Barack Obama. And when you have 59 precincts that are voting 21,000 to zero, it's not going to be very easy for Mitt Romney to appeal to the African-American vote. There were other issues involved. That being said, had he got, let's say, 35% of the Latino vote, and let's say 12% of the African-American vote, or take another group, so-called Asians, if there is such a group of such diverse backgrounds, but nevertheless, they have about a 5% higher per capita income than the so-called white average. And yet he lost those supposedly by 70-30. Had he got just 35 of those, now how he would have got those extra 5 or 6 points that would put those key states in play, I think he would have done it, as I said, by not being a Bain capitalist outsourcing person who cheats on his taxes and doesn't fill out federal forms. In other words, there were candidates in that primary that were flawed and wouldn't have done as well, but they were from different classes. Had they been good candidates and avoided some of the lunatic positions, but so-called men of the people or women of the people, they would have done much better. So the Republicans, they don't have to win those targeted constituencies, but they have to get up from 30 to 35 to 40%. And at times they've done that. And the way they've done it is that, like Reagan did, or George Bush in 2004, they don't allow themselves to be caricatured. It's not just tactics or strategy. It has to be genuine. They have to be, maybe the next Democratic, I don't care what is the next Republican candidate, won't really matter what his ethnic surname is or whether he speaks this language or that language, but it will matter that whether he owns a tire store, whether he was a salesperson, rather than somebody who's a member of the aristocracy. I think the Republicans, their message of self-reliance accepts some degree of inequality, and their argument is that everybody will be better off, even if some people are more better off, and that's better than having everybody not so well off and equal. And that is an easily caricatured argument unless they have the messenger as a person who's familiar with the working class.
So part of it, excuse me, part of it really is the candidate. But, you know, when you take a look at what needs to be done, and Mr. Hansen, you've spelled it out very well here in some areas, but, you know, it's just not nationally. You have to take a look, at the party here in California with the dominance of the Democrats. And sometimes even in the state legislature, the Republicans not even voting on certain legislation. And I would think that most people would say that's not good. I think most people want a healthy, competitive two-party system or more. So, I mean, what does that mean if we get to the point where one party becomes irrelevant? What can happen?
Well, we've seen it in American history. There was no such thing as a Republican Party in the South for 100 years. And there may not be anything such a thing as a Republican Party in California, but that's a problem. That's really a process of demographic change. We're losing 2,000 people a week, and that's over 150,000 who are leaving California. And I expect that when these tax rates are retroactively enacted, which they will be soon, we're going to get even more people. And most of the people, the 2,000, make over $70,000. Of the last 11 million people that were added to the population of California, when it went from 26 million to 37 million, of that 11 million increase, 8 million went on Medicaid out of 11 million new Californians. And whatever your policy is, that's a demographic reality. One-third of all the welfare recipients in the United States live in California, even though the population is somewhere between 1/6 and 1/7. These are just facts, that they're not partisan. So that represents a constituency who defines family values as sort of an all-caring, all-encompassing government that feels that certain people, even though in California, if you look at the percentage that pays, it's about 1% is paying almost 50% of the income tax, which makes almost 45 to 50% of the general revenue. And that group is very rapidly shrinking. At some point, very soon, I think, California is going to have some very tough questions. And they're going to say, for this very generous entitlement program, we don't have enough people that are paying that 50% of the income tax revenue, which is 50% of the general revenue. We need more revenue. Now, we saw that Prop 13 will slightly increase the sales tax, but the ability to tax that 1% is reaching its logical limitations. So California is going to have some tough decisions. Going to say, you know what, we have a lot of gas and oil. You want to drill it? You can go up on the mid-coast, or you can do fracking or horizontal drilling. There's a lot of money there. We have a lot of timber. Do you want to go after that? We have ag prices are at record highs. Do we really want to idle more farmland? But it'll be choices that Democrats are going to have to make with Democrats, because they got what they wanted, and we'll see whether it works or not. But there's not enough of the plutocratic 1% anymore. They're either leaving the state or they're not that affluent anymore to fund the current tax structure. It's just not going to work.
The Republican Party certainly is scrambling for its existence in California, and may be able to find a hold in these kind of things that Professor Hansen's talking about. Nationally, though, I don't think the Republican Party, even if it does end up becoming a regional party that cannot effectively compete in a presidential election of the next few years, it's not going to disappear. We are fundamentally a two-party country. We are not a one-party country. We are not a three-party country. We are a two-party country. We think about our politics in left-right terms, and that creates the kind of mental space you need to have a two-party system. And in my lifetime, every time I heard that one party is, you know, trying to figure out how it can survive, and people are starting to, you know, write the epitaph of the party, then all of a sudden it comes roaring back. We've seen that several times. We saw that in 2010. We saw that in 2006, and further on back. So, I mean, the Republican Party is going to probably be able to refine its message, find a winning solution that's going to bring them back and keep them relevant, because, frankly, American people want a second party.
Oh, I agree with that. I think I was trying to get that way in a clumsy situation, because if you look at 1964 and the LBJ landslide, and by 68 Richard Nixon, then the 72 Nixon landslide when they said the Democratic Party was over, Jimmy Carter comes back, and then Ronald Reagan. So we have that yin and yang, and It's because it usually parties overreach. In the case of California, as I said, I was trying to get to the point that we're going to see the logical limitations or logical extensions or logical ramifications of a blue state ideology. And when that is reached, and if it doesn't work, then there'll be a lot of people who will offer alternative points of view, as happened in the past.
I just want to add one more thing there. What the Republican Party nationally needs to do is take care of its own internal fractures. In a sense, that's what hobbled Mitt Romney quite a bit, especially elements like the Tea Party, who to some extent created, I would say, the perception that the Republican Party, you know, how do I say that this nicely? The Republican Party, they gave the impression that portions of the Republican Party were really, you know, out of touch, or as we say, I guess, wing nuts. And you saw that in some of the Senate races in Indiana and in the Todd Aiken race that really cost Republicans seats in the Senate that they ought to have had. The Republican Party needs to deal with its own internal fractions. Once they get that done and can refine a good message that kind of feeds into a lot of American myths and the myths of self-reliance, being able to bring yourself up, that Professor Hansen's talked about. Once they can do that, then they'll be a competitive party again.
Well, I agree with that. I think that the Tea Party did a lot of good in the cases of Marco Rubio and Cruz in Texas when they stuck to physical populism and Washington's out of touch on your money and taxes. They did very well, especially when they attracted different types of candidates. But when they got into social issues, they had some people who said things that not only hurt them in the Senate, but resonated into the national election. And they were picked up by the Obama in brilliant fashion and pretty much said that Mitt Romney is equivalent or synonymous with Aiken. And that really hurt him in certain constituencies, especially young women in key states. So they how you control that, I don't know. The Democrats used to have the same problem, and that was that, as I said earlier, they couldn't elect a northern liberal. Why? Because somebody like Dukakis or somebody like Kerry would have members of the left that were so extreme, they would say crazy things, sort of the Michael Moore, Cindy Sheehan faction, and they weren't able to discipline them or discipline. Barack Obama's asset is that he's been able to take the hard left and incorporate it within the party and make it behave, more or less, so that you don't have a Michael Moore or Bill Maher, but when they say things, Obama's been able to distance himself from it or to say that this doesn't represent mainstream democratic liberalism. And so, anytime a party can do that, they do well.
Yeah. So it would be in any party, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. It really is, I think, when you take a look at it, that people who are down the middle, the moderates in the Democratic Party and the moderates in the Republican Party, really do have to kind of fight against the extremes. And so do you think it's going to take a more moderate approach?
Yeah, I think it is. If you take the Latino vote, for example, I speak as someone who's got a lot of Latinos within my family. I live there with them. There's two strategies, and one is what I would call the salad bowl strategy. That's what the Democratic Party, I think, is doing, where it has a hyphenated Latino Americans for Obama, Black Americans for Obama. This particular group gets a particular agenda, this particular group, this particular, and you craft together factions and you craft 51%. But I think that's not going to work for the Republicans, because a lot of things that would be necessary for them to appeal on these in a salad bowl fashion would not work. It would be contrary to their larger orthodoxy. So what would they do? And I think it's the Italian-American solution for them. It's long-term, but if you look today, a left-wing person does not vote for Rudy Giuliani because he's Italian, and a right-wing person does not vote who's Italian-American for Andrew Cuomo because he's Italian. And there's not an Italian studies program in most of the universities. And people don't really – in other words, being Italian is incidental, not essential to your persona. That's happening with Latinos all the time. But the difference between Latinos is because of the proximity of Mexico and the fact we've had 11 to 14 million illegal aliens – that the natural processes of upward mobility and assimilation are taking longer. So that if you're a Hispanic person and you live, let's say, in Clovis, your assimilation is going to be different if you live in Selma than Parlier. And what the Republicans need to do is say, I'm all for the DREAM Act if that's a way to close the border and return immigration to a legal process. But once that returns to a legal process and you do not have 500,000 people coming without English, without a high school diploma, and without legally, and they're no different than any other group, and legal immigration is ethnically blind, so to speak, and predicated on other issues such as, you know, education or skill sets, then I think what will happen is the pool of Hispanics within the United States will follow the traditional 19th and early 20th century Italian and American, and within, you know, 20 years, the so-called Latino vote will be 50-50 or 40-60, one way or the other.
Right.
And being a Latino won't be something that's any more than being Swedish-American means anything to me, other than, you know, laughing at buying an Electrolux vacuum cleaner or Volvo. But we're not there yet because of this artifact of illegal immigration.
But another real discussion that needs to be had. And when we do, I do hope you come back. But for the time being, we're going to have to close this discussion. Victor Davis Hanson, it was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us today. Victor Davis Hanson, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stafford University, and Professor Thomas Holyoke, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fresno State. Thank you both. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson. The San Joaquin Valley is surrounded by some of the state's most beautiful environmental treasures. But for many Valley residents, especially those in poverty, the environment they live in is very different, filled with polluted water and air, and conditions that some compare to third world nations. But there is an effort to change that underway right now in Fresno. There is a new agency aimed at empowering communities to report pollution and other environmental problems they see in their own neighborhoods. It's called FERN, Fresno Environmental Reporting Network. And joining us to discuss this issue is Sarah Aird. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on Valley Edition.
Now, it's my understanding that this organization has been active in Bakersfield. Why did you decide, or folks decide, to form FERN?
Sure, and I'm happy to explain it a little bit. So it's not exactly a new agency per se, but it is a new system for community-friendly environmental reporting. And the reason why we brought it to Fresno is because we see a lot of the same challenges in Kern County and in Fresno County. This new system allows community members who we consider to be the local experts on their surroundings and on environmental violations that they may see or experience. And this gives them an opportunity to directly report environmental violations and overcome a lot of obstacles to reporting that we've seen in both counties. So just to give you an example, many of the obstacles that we see to the people we work with being able to report environmental violations has been language barriers. This new system allows people to report in English or in Spanish. They can report an environmental violation any time, day or night. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be between 9 and 5. They can do it anonymously. A lot of people are actually afraid to submit reports for a variety of reasons. They don't have to do it using their own name if they're uncomfortable with that. And through this new system, they also don't have to know which agency is responsible for handling the violation. And that's another really big obstacle that we see to people currently not reporting environmental violations. So that's what this new system is really designed to do, is to overcome those obstacles and let the community really get involved in identifying the problems in their community.
Now, you went over some of this earlier, but how does this really work? So people, do they call in? Do they contact you over the internet? Just how exactly do they go about reporting what they say?
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing that we're really excited about. We're using new technologies through this system. So people can really report in four different ways. First, they can call in to 559-202-FERN. And they can also text to that number, but no photos. So those are two ways that people can contact us and submit a report. They can also email to reports@fresnoreport.org. And then finally, the great thing about this system is we have a public website where all reports come into and are posted online along with status updates, so people can actually see what's happening to the reports that they've submitted. But you can also submit a report online, and that's at www.fresnoreport.org.
Why do you think it's important that people be allowed to do this without being identified?
Sure. So in our case, I'll just speak specifically about the coalition that I work for, Californians for Pesticide Reform. So in our case, we work with many, many people who work in the fields, many farm workers who experience problems related to pesticides, and they've been very fearful. We've been working in this area now for over a decade in the Valley, and many people are really hesitant to report pesticide incidents because they're concerned about losing their jobs. So through this system, if there is something where they think that pesticides are being used improperly or there's some kind of a problem, they can report this directly, but they can do it anonymously so they don't have to worry about losing a job. So that's just one example of why that anonymous component is so important.
What happens after they report a problem to the agency?
Absolutely. So we have a problem solver that's on the receiving end of receiving the reports, and that person just vets them to make sure that it's not a prank, or occasionally we'll get reported violations in that are outside of the particular county where we're working, and this is really restricted to Fresno. So that person, that problem solver, will go through those reports and then will approve for posting all of them that are valid and that, you know, aren't something like a prank. So that's how they get posted online. And then we have every third Monday of the month, our next meeting is going to be November 19th, we have a completely public meeting that involves local, regional, state, and federal agencies, as well as community members and community-based organizations who get together once a month, and we actually go over each report and determine how each report is getting addressed.
And you say how they're getting addressed. Is there action taken after that? Do you pass it on to another agency? I think people will want to know that if they see something that they think is wrong or that they run a report, that, you know, what is the result of them reporting this?
Absolutely. That's one of the things we're really excited about with this model. A lot of times what we find is when people do submit reports, even if they do submit to the proper agency, a lot of times there's a gap, and it's you know, not necessarily a fault of the agencies, but a lot of times someone will submit a report and then they don't know what happens. With Fern, everything is public and transparent. So if someone wants to submit a report and they have a concern about a specific violation and they want to follow up, the follow-up information is actually posted on the website. So not just the violation, but also which agency is taking responsibility for looking into that report and then what actually happens with the violation. In addition to that, these monthly meetings on the third Monday of each month are open to the public, so everyone is welcome to attend those, and that's another way that people can learn what's happened with their particular report or any of the reports that that Fern is dealing with.
What are some of the issues people are facing here in Fresno and the Central Valley as to why you all felt it was important to give them this tool when it came to reporting possible pollution?
Sure. We've seen actually a number of different concerns throughout the Valley, and most of which also are problems within Fresno. So, for example, water contamination is a really strong concern, and we've had reports on concerns around water violations come up pretty regularly. Pesticides, because there are many areas within the Valley that are, you know, agriculturally based, obviously. Pesticide drift and pesticide incidents are another big concern. In addition, I think because of the agricultural, you know, based base of the communities. We've also seen concerns around just air quality in general, that with the trucks coming by, there are high levels of diesel in the air. So that's another area in which we see a lot of concerns for people's health and safety. In addition to that, there have been some instances where people have been reporting dumping, illegal dumping in certain circumstances, or some poles have been also stuffed with trash, and it's been a hazard for children who might go over and want to sort of play in that area. So it's been really, a broad variety. Those are just a few of the types of violations that we're seeing.
Now, are you working with local agencies on this?
We are, yes. We do have local agencies involved. We have local, state, and federal agencies involved. So we actually just had an environmental justice bus tour on Wednesday, October 17th, and we had really strong representation from local agencies, and even had Dr. Ed Moreno, the director and health officer of Fresno County Department of Community Health, participate in a press conference announcing our new model.
Okay. We'd like to thank you for joining us, Sarah Arad, with the Fresno Environmental Reporting Network. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Some 4 years after the biggest economic meltdown since the Great Depression, the effects are still being felt across the country. And besides the basic toll on the economy, the government's response to the crisis has also called some to reconsider the role of everything from government bailouts to the so-called safety net of social programs. In this week's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business professor Ida Jones says our problems require a new approach.
What happened to the government safety net for homeowners whose mortgages are underwater? These homeowners, the true victims of the 2008 financial crisis, have yet to receive assistance. The promise of the Great Society, where government helps to provide education, health care, and other basic human needs, has been replaced by a $170 billion system of taxpayer bailouts for those whose mismanagement and greed caused the financial crisis in the first place. To rescue the economy, Congress adopted government bailout measures, including the Troubled Assets Recovery Program, or TARP, financial rescues of mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and programs to help individual homeowners. Congress then created a special prosecutor's office to prevent misuse of TARP funds. In other words, financial mismanagement, some of it criminal, caused the financial crisis. Government provided taxpayer funds to financial executives and managers who caused the crisis. Then, recognizing that these same folks could not be trusted, government created a special prosecutor to oversee distribution and use of the funds. However, homeowners, who are the true victims of the financial crisis, still await rescue. Now, according to the website ProPublica, TARP funds were given to nearly 1,000 institutions and companies. Many of those funds have been recovered. That is, they've been paid back. The bailout of mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, according to the new group managing those lenders, has little hope of recovering much of that money. The Special Prosecutor's Office, created to stop continued mismanagement by financial executives, has paid for itself in watchdogging expenditure of TARP funds. It's filed criminal charges against many, secured convictions of some, recovered millions in assets, and filed suits to recover more. Overall, though TARP has been able to help financial institutions and auto companies survive, but what about homeowners? Homeowners who were also promised help haven't received it. According to the Special Prosecutor's Office, by the end of 2010, only 6% of the homeowners had been helped through the fund that was created for that purpose. It's outrageous that those who caused the financial crisis were able to successfully and immediately get funds, but that individual homeowners, who were, in part, victims of poor decisions and recommendations by financial experts, haven't received the same immediate relief. So are there solutions so that taxpayers will not have to provide future bailouts to companies? Yes, there are. As a country, we should refocus on providing for people, creating opportunities, and disclaiming greed. We must re-regulate the finance industry. Let's return to the days when banks were required to conservatively manage taxpayer money. Let's revive that vision of the Great Society, the vision of a safety net for individuals provided by government support of key resources. Let's toss out the current vision, where taxpayers provide a safety net for those who permitted greed and unfettered, unabashed, and ill-considered methods of competition to cost taxpayers billions. Government should continue to try to recover taxpayer funds, strengthen the regulations on the finance industry to prevent future bailouts, aggressively prosecute those whose greed caused the losses, and provide real and immediate assistance to homeowners who are underwater. That's the safety net we can and should provide, one that permits opportunities for all as human beings. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. It is one of those traditions that really makes the Christmas season come alive here in the Valley, and that is Christmas at Kearney. But it has been gone for a while. It is back, and we're so happy about that. And here to tell us more about it is Cindy Walton, Fresno, with the Fresno Historical Society. Tell us a little bit about this. You were saying, we were discussing before we came back on, that the tradition, we haven't had Christmas at Kearney in 7 years. What happened?
Yes, I know. It's been a 7-year break. And I think it's just, it was one of those beloved traditions that kind of went by the wayside. But we really had the impetus to bring it back because not only did we get calls all the time saying, bring back Christmas at Kearney, but it's actually our 50th anniversary of the Society running Kearney Mansion Museum. So in celebration of that and trying to do more, and we just finished up the Civil War Revisited, we thought, oh, come on, let's just bring it back.
You know, what a way to celebrate the 50th anniversary. And when you talk about 7 years, you're talking about the fact that some people may have never experienced this. So this is going to be all new to a whole group of people, and that sounds great. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing.
Sure. Well, we're doing a whole series of events, and I think that the one that everyone's most interested in is the Victorian Christmas teas, and we'll be doing those most weekends from about December 7th through the 21st, and we have 2 sittings a day, and it's just walking into this beautiful mansion completed in 1903 in true Victorian style, and it is going to be fully decorated. We're going to often have live period musicians. We'll have maybe a little gift, and you'll get to really see the mansion in more of its glory and in a way that even celebrates it more than just if you went on the public tour, say, during the rest of the year.
And so when can people, do they need to make reservations for the teas? Or?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to call the Fresno Historical Society at 441-0862. There's a little bit of information up on our website, valleyhistory.org, but better to call because there's lots of options for the teas or other, you know, Christmas-related events.
I know. I can remember years back taking my daughter to one of those, and it was just so much fun.
It really is beautiful, and most people don't get out to see the mansion, and they think, I think mentally we think it's very far away, but it's 15
not.
Minutes from downtown. So just the drive along Kearney Boulevard with the palm trees and the historic park, it's stepping back in time, that something you've just forgotten about.
You know, I call it a nice little quick getaway. What are some of the other things that you're bringing back that people will be able to enjoy during the Christmas season?
Well, for those who maybe can't do a full tea, we are doing open houses for the general public, so you at least get to see the house. And those will be on 3 Sundays in December. And then we have a members-only party. And then also we're offering for the first time corporate parties. So if your business is looking to do their Christmas party in a unique location, Kearney Mansion might be just the right place.
And it's a great way to support the Historical Society and to really help maintain the mansion, because that's just so special.
We've got a lot of work there. Like I said, the Fresno Historical Society has been out there for 50 years. And I think a if it hadn't been for our presence in that building, it might not even be in the condition it is, and we still have a long ways to go. So come out and support one of our great historic locations.
So, I think that's something that people need to know, because a lot of times, like you said, if you don't get out there, if you don't hear about it, you don't understand that it's taken a lot of work to restore that, to keep it up. And it's a true part of the Valley's history that you don't want to lose.
It's true. I really feel that if the society hasn't been there for our 50 years, I don't think anyone would be seeing it. Because, you know, we do school tours all the time. In fact, that's part of one of our Christmas events. This whole work week is nothing but school tours. And just regular tours to the general public. I hate to imagine what the mansion would be like if we hadn't stayed there and really given it the love and attention that we can.
What does it take to decorate?
Oh my gosh. We've been at it for weeks and we're not even close to being done. I just walked into the state office and reception room last night, and we just had the fresh trees delivered, and it was just stunning. The Victorians really favored natural decoration. So we actually went out into Kearney Park and picked some of the laurel and different things, which we used to do back when we were doing this, to help decorate the mansion. We're really trying to keep it in the style of the Victorian era, which is a lot of natural earthy things.
And the real Christmas trees.
Yeah, the smell in the mansions. It's just, I walk in the mansion pretty frequently for my job, but nothing like the way it's looking right now.
And what times? I know you talked about the teas and the tours, but just what times is it open, and when can people come?
I think the best introduction and inexpensive introduction is the three open houses on Sundays. That is December 2nd, 9th, and 16th from 1 to 4 p.m. And it's a park fee. The park always charges a fee for each vehicle. But then once you get inside, it's $10 for adults and less for students and children. But you get a full tour. It's about an hour and a half experience where you will get the full tour of the mansion, and you'll have a little bit of punch and cookies, and you really get to see it in the Christmas spirit.
This is something that's returning after 7 years, or is it going to continue? I'm sure people will want to know that, or we sure hope so.
I hope so, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it is a big production to put on each year, but we really have to have response from the public to make it worth doing. It's an investment by the society, by both staff and financially, so we really need the public to support stuff like this.
Yeah, and maybe so, with it being gone for 7 years, folks will realize just how much they miss it, and will come and enjoy during this holiday. It makes for a great holiday getaway.
It does, and I hear so many people say, with the loss of the Fresno Metropolitan Museum, this is kind of the
definitely.
Next best thing. So this is your chance to have what you felt there.
Well, it sounds great. I'm glad you were able to come this morning and let people know about it.
Thank you.
And it starts then this weekend. There will be...
Yes, well, the school tours start this week, but our first public event is Saturday, and that's for the society members, but then the first open house is on Sunday.
Okay, thanks so much, Cindy Wathen with the Fresno Historical Society, coming in today to talk to us about Christmas at Kearney, an event you don't want to miss. So try to get out there sometime during the month of December. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.